As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking about some unlikely heroes at Old Trafford, a reality check at St James's Park, and important away wins for Arsenal and Manchester City. We'll also discuss Wayne Rooney's start to his career as Birmingham manager, and joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we've got Martin Samuel, chief correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Jonathan Northcroft, Sunday Times football correspondent, and a former footballer who played 15 times for Scotland's under-21s and once went up against a Spain team including Andres Iniesta, Cesc Fabregas and Sergio Ramos. And he lived to tell the tale, and he's with us now, Gregor Robertson. That's a pretty good one, I think.
Yeah, I'll take that one.
Yeah, come on, that's a good one.
I've deigned out in that for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. And I've saved it back till nearly November. Anyway, so lots to discuss to Old Trafford and also to the Times Sport offices. It's Tuesday night. It's nearly 10 p.m. The online match report is ready to be published. The back page of the newspaper is ready to be sent. I've written the headline, Maguire to the rescue for Ten Hag. And then Scott McTominay gives away a penalty. We moan, we swear, we prepare for a quick change in tone. And then up steps a hero, Andre Onana. And all is well again. A crucial 3 points for Manchester United and a smooth editing process for me, which allowed me to get my 10:30 train back home. Big win for Manchester United, and I'm going to start with Onana because he's someone that we've talked about on this Thursday show before with this exact cast of people. I thought he looked better, not just in this game, not just the penalty save. He made a couple of good saves before that, Johnny. Mm. How much do you think he's improved, or is this a kind of slight papering over the cracks with an exciting save at the end?
No, because I think this is more of a rebalancing to where he was. He was playing way below the standards that we saw at Inter Milan, and before that Ajax, he was clearly a keeper struggling for confidence. And interesting reading some of Paul Huss writing about this, that one of the things that United have tried to work on with him is how he reacts to setbacks and how he's reacted to making mistakes, and that's a key thing for a goalkeeper, which is to be able to live in the moment and put anything behind them and deal with the next save. And he did seem to be struggling with that. A sort of disappointing start to the season with the mistake in pre-season, the one he got away with against Wolves seemed to play on his mind. He does look like he's been able to reset himself mentally. He's making some very good saves. I still don't think we're seeing the kind of sweeper-keeper football that one would have expected from him. It was a fantastic penalty save. I'm rooting for the guy from the point of view that you don't often see players who are so open and honest about taking responsibility for errors as he has been. And he's getting back to what I think we knew he was, which is a very talented goalkeeper, but I'd also say still an unpredictable one. And that's a question going forward. I don't think we'll not see him make fantastic saves and have great moments. It's how much solidity and assurance he can deliver over time, and how much his sweeper-keeper style is useful to a team which is dysfunctional in other ways.
Martin, goalkeepers were subject of one of your column items this week, not just talking about Andre Onana, but also about Chelsea and Arsenal as well. Mm. What do you make to some of the points Johnny's raised there about Andre Onana?
I thought he had a good game.
That it?
Yeah, is it? Yeah, I thought he had a good game. I've seen about 10 of his or whatever so far this season. I haven't seen too many good ones. That was a very good one. I mean, it was as simple as that. As soon as they got the penalty, I'm thinking he saves this, because I didn't fancy it was a substitute that came on, wasn't it?
Yes, Larson.
And you're just thinking, well, I'm not sure that's their first choice penalty taker. And also in terms of Sod's Law, if you write about anybody who is playing, they will do the exact opposite of, you know, of what you need to happen in some ways. So, you know, he saved the penalty and he was the hero of the night. And fantastic, and I hope he comes on. But yeah, it's a good game. That's what it is. It's a good game. Goalkeepers are allowed to have them.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, Martin's alluding to a moment there that I missed out in my intro, which was as the chaos was happening, phone rings. Martin Samuel needs to change his column. I was like, not now, Martin, for goodness sake. There's a load of...
But no professionalism, you see. That, you know, if this was on YouTube.
Martin has just thrown something at me across the studio. But, Gregor, coming back to some of those points that Johnny made about rooting for him almost, and it looked like his teammates were rooting for him as well, didn't it? Like, you almost wonder, and we alluded to this on Monday's show, that with Manchester United, that this kind of attitude of plucky underdogs almost that they've got at the minute, because they've been quite poor for a while and that they've had some injuries, that's almost seems to be working for them in a way, where they're getting these moments and they're going for them. It's something that James Gearbrand referred to in his piece of analysis after. But moments only go so far, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's obviously a big night for Onana and Maguire. Good narrative there. I agree with you. Onana looks like he's clearly a big character, and his teammates were obviously very, very pleased for him, and it was a huge roar. And you know, after the start, he's had a big moment for him. But I kind of agree with Martin. I think much like I said about Maguire the other night, it's like, you can slightly too easily and swiftly and quickly sort of say that he's back and this is you know, the start of something new. You need to see it over a longer period of time, and I think the point that Johnny made about, you know, the sweeper keeper, what we expected from him, is still probably the biggest issue. I think, you know, he would have been disappointed letting in some of the goals he has, but I think that probably was, you know, individual mistakes. And we know he's a good goalkeeper. He saw it in the Champions League. What he was signed to do, he's still not doing. And it's not all his fault either. It's partly to do with who's in front of him. But that assimilation into the team in terms of sort of changing the style of play and the way that Ten Hag wanted Manchester United to evolve, it's not happened yet.
You mentioned Ten Hag and the way he wanted to play. Johnny, you know, we were watching that first half and I was watching it in the office thinking, God, how do you sell this? It's going to be 0-0. I mean, other than another disastrous night for Manchester United. But he was proactive. He made the change at half-time with Christian Eriksen, which did make a big difference. And they looked a lot better. Were it not for some heavy touches from Marcus Rashford and other forwards, they could have won maybe two or three.
They did. But this is where we are with Ten Hag. 18 months in, we're still waiting for the Ten Hag pattern of play, really, I would say, and waiting for consistency. And we talk about moments. We're seeing United having really good moments, often repair the damage of the previous game that this has gone on. You know, I was there when Scott McTominay scored twice from the beat Brentford, and Ten Hag was hailed for a great substitution. But you know, what about the other 85 minutes before McTominay came on? And I think that's where we still are. We're seeing a team that's kind of still bouncing a little bit from game to game and moment to moment, good moment to good moment, with a lot of dross in between, quite frankly. And the point about Onana is that famously the template for this, I suppose, is Guardiola bringing in first Claudio Bravo and then Edison, and you know, doing that despite having a very good traditional goalkeeper in place in Joe Hart at the time. But what Guardiola was also doing was configuring his team to play positional football, possession football, so that when the sweeper keeper did come in, he actually had people to play to. Now, I don't think it's been hard to judge Onana on that aspect, because when he gets the ball, quite often United are running away from him and they're still playing on the counter-attack.
His out ball is always this
bang it up.
Yeah. Clip into midfield. Yeah. It's a clip out to a wide player, half out the pitch.
Yeah.
It's telegraphed, and so the opposition are straight onto it, so it never has the impact, or rarely has the impact, that it should do. Basically. Whereas you see what Ederson does for Manchester City, he actually plays a ball that gets them away.
Yeah, and he's got people to play to.
Yeah,
and they've worked on it. I was at Leicester on Tuesday, actually, and Maresca's, you know, learnt from Guardiola. I mean, they had about 4 or 5 different build-up shapes when the keeper had the ball. They changed them during the game to stop Sunderland with the opponents sort of succeeding with their press. Every time Sunderland did something, Leicester changed their build-up patterns, their shape. I don't see any of that from United.
So is that on Ten Hag, or is that on the fact that, you know, to take your Guardiola City analogy, he signed his keeper, he now needs to sign 4 new defenders, 3 new defenders alongside Lissandro Martinez as well. But in order to play that way, who are going to make the runs and give him the passing options?
I think it's on Ten Hag, and it's on I suppose the recruiters as well. But the point with, I guess, with Guardiola is it was the goalkeeper was part of a whole process, and everything started from day one with Pep. Everything, all the patterns started from day one, the work on the training ground started from day one, and we've seen how it's evolved over time with fullbacks in midfield and blah blah blah. But it's all part of a kind of unified design, and this is 18 months in for Ten Hag, so the goalkeeper should be slotting into something already there, and that's what I can't really see the pattern that's already there. I can see bits of it, you know, he likes width, he likes to play with wingers like Dutch coaches do. But when it comes to what's happening positionally in terms of keeping the ball in midfield, getting overloads to outnumber the opposition in areas so you can pass around the map, I don't see a lot of that from United. Maybe I'm being harsh, but I don't know.
Yeah, they're also in this position where they're celebrating wins. I know you think that they're celebrating wins that a good team takes for granted. Mm. Brentford at home.
but the nature of it was a late winner, like two goals in the late 90s.
But
plus.
It's still you're still celebrating something that previously you beat Brentford at home because you're Manchester United and they're Brentford, and I know that makes it sound as if it's easy. It's not easy, but it's what happens. Tottenham are celebrating wins that feel like landmark victories or landmark results. So they go to Arsenal and everyone's saying, this will expose Tottenham for what that... And they've beaten Arsenal. However it happens against Liverpool, whatever fortuitous breaks have gone their way, they end up beating Liverpool. They end up getting a result.
Yeah.
And so you look at this and you think, well, these are actual proper results. Mm. These are good results. Whereas with Manchester United, you're only actually getting what you thought you were going to get anyway.
In the context, I completely agree with you, because I remember me outlining this run of fixtures. This is the end of that run of fixtures that I think the four of us talked about to give him the chance to build his season before facing Manchester City in the derby. But in the context of the start of that run of fixtures, where they lose to Galatasaray and they lose other matches, to then win 3 on the bounce, even in the nature that you're saying, is that not a positive thing that they should be taking away, and that they should be jumping around and leaping on each other?
Every win you can take positively. All I'm looking at is when that group was drawn, Manchester United's Champions League group, nobody looked at it and thought, Copenhagen away, that's going to be a cup final.
You're
thinking that, you know... They come second to Bayern Munich. That's what you're thinking. They'll come second to Bayern Munich. This is fairly straightforward, this group. Mm. This is a 2+2 group. Mm. There'll be two teams that run away with it, and, you know, one of them will beat the other one when they play, and that will decide who wins it, and the other two teams will fall by the wayside. It's not like, say, Newcastle's group, which is... There's 4 teams there that you looked at and you thought, well, this could be anything. This group could be absolutely anything. United's group you looked at... Oh, this is 2+2.
Gregor?
James made another good point in his column that was the kind of the redemption stories. So, you know, they're relying on Maguire, who not so long, very, very recently was the fifth choice centre half. to kind of come up with a goal. They rely on McTominay, who they've really been trying to usher out the team, if not the club, to decide games now. And so you could look at that as a positive thing, of course. And, you know, they fought their way back into the team. But these are players that Man United are trying to move on from, and they're still relying upon them to get results. And he also referenced the thing in midfield, which I kind of agree to. They still can't get the balance right in midfield at all. About, you know, if Amrabat's playing, he's almost like the single pivot. But it just isn't working, and they can't play through the thirds. They can't really get out. They're quite easy to hem in. And then obviously that makes it harder. We're talking about Onana trying to build from the back, and they still cannot get the midfield balance right. And then, you know, he changes that at half time, puts on Eriksen for Amrabat, and so it's like you're kind of sacrificing one thing, i.e. sort of legs, industry, you know, ball winning ability for someone who's a bit of a luxury, really, in Christian Eriksen, who can't get around, but he can pull the strings and he can play in delicious ball. So they just don't have, they've either got one thing or the other, and they can't even get a partnership that creates the right balance in midfield.
The parts have got to fit together. So you bring in a sweeper keeper, but then you play with two of the slowest centre halves in the league. So how does that work? You know, the back line needs to push up if you can have a sweeper keeper to give him space to do his thing. I mean, it's things like that that blow your mind, that this is 18 months down the line. It's not just Ten Hag, is it? It's years of this. But I just think United's recent history has been, they've depended on individual players and their surges of form. You know, Casemiro last year had a great sort of 4 or 5 month spell. So United, he took United with them. Bruno Fernandes did it when he arrived. He took United with him. Rashford had a great surge of scoring. But they're still... Pogba even had this spell when he led Solskjaer's team to an unbeaten run. But they're still relying on an individual hitting a hot streak and not the pattern.
And it looks... It hasn't moved on greatly from what you used to look at with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's team, where you sort of thought, they look sort of uncoached. Now, that's... You know, I'm not saying they're uncoached, but Ten Hag is clearly a coach. He's clearly a good coach. But under Oli, it sometimes looks as if what they've done is they've slung the best 11 players out, and someone's going to do something. And if someone does something, because they're Manchester United players, so they're all good players. And, you know, they're not buying mugs. They're buying good players. So someone might do something, and then they win. But you're looking at it thinking... But it doesn't actually look particularly as if it's been thought out or planned. And it hasn't moved greatly on from that. So, as you say, McTominay at the moment, the penalty award notwithstanding, but McTominay at the moment is in this purple patch of form for United when he comes on, for Scotland when he plays. He's suddenly turned into Frank Lampard as far as goal scoring is concerned. No one can quite work it out. But... And that drags them by the scruff of the neck and gets them over the line. And it doesn't look as if in 6 months' time you're not looking at United at the moment and thinking there'll be a shape, there'll be a plan, this is where they're going, this is where they're heading, this is how it sets up, this is what happens.
I just think it's important to say for me anyway, overwhelmingly that is down to the dysfunction of Manchester United more than Erik ten Hag.
Yeah,
yeah.
So,
yeah,
like,
that's fair enough.
Whatever. Erik ten Hag will never, ever make Manchester United compete for the title while Manchester United are still run like they have been under the Glazers. I don't think it'll ever happen.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about big issues there. And, Johnny, you talked about individuals. I wanted to just finish with Harry Maguire because we kind of, you know, Onana takes the headlines as he did on Tuesday night, and understandably so. And then we've had a fascinating debate on the status of Ten Hag United. But in terms of the individuals and Maguire, we do love a redemption story, don't we, as journalists? And I'm not saying it's complete, but it's impressive.
You were on Thursday.
It's Monday.
Monday. Sorry,
I was just trying to cheer you up. You were in a bad mood. I thought the Defenders Alliance would kick in. But it's a good thing, isn't it, for Harry Maguire? And it is quite impressive for what he's done.
It is, and one thing that Harry's always had and is rock solid personality and self belief. You have to admire him for it. He's shown that for England with some of the treatment he's taken and the fact he's plugged away. And it's kind of typical of him that he's plugged away and got back to some kind of authority at United. And he had another, like Martin said with Onana, he had a really good game. There was maybe one or two moments where he was done for pace, but he had some other really good moments.
I don't think he has always had rock solid belief.
Do you not?
I think he's had enough to put himself in uncomfortable positions. I think there's a difference. I think he's not someone who you look at and think he's saying damn all you. Mm. I'm going to show you. I think he's got enough personality to put himself in a difficult position.
Is that not more impressive?
It's just a slightly different trait. It is impressive because, you know, you'll know that the eyes of the world are looking at him, and often quite scornfully of late. But he's still willing to go out there. And in fact, he chose to stay and put himself in that position to try and, you know, drag himself back to something close to the form he's capable of.
But what's the difference between that and rock solid belief in?
I don't think he has got rock solid belief in himself. There's a difference between having real belief in yourself and being willing to put yourself in an uncomfortable position. And I think he fits into the latter camp.
So you'd see doubt in his game when he plays.
I think he's someone who does feel doubt. I think we see that in him. I don't think he's like, you know. Who's got rock solid belief? Who are players? You look at like a Roy Keane or, you know, big kind of talismanic players. He's not like that.
So are you talking about character or footballing ability?
I don't think it's footballing ability. I think it's his personality. I've said this before. I think his personality is not necessarily that of a kind of bona fide leader.
Martin?
Yeah, well, look, there's some people that look, that people imagine to be a certain way. And they're not. Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard, who looked like the most confident, particularly Steve, looked like the most confident people in the world, and were actually quite unsure of their game. People who worked with them at international level said that they were surprised that they weren't actually, once the dressing room door was shut, these guys that felt super confident in their ability and what was going on. They had doubts about their game, they had doubts about whether they were effective, and they were a lot more fragile, and this could perhaps explain why certain things didn't work for them with England. They were a lot more fragile as personalities than one would imagine. Probably not at club level, where they were surrounded by a system that was functioning a lot better than it was for them with England. But to look at Steven Gerrard, you would think this is a guy that's never had a doubt in his mind that he's the greatest player on the pitch, and it wasn't like that at all.
I think I think a surprising number of people, in fact, almost everyone, feels those sorts of self doubts. But and I'm being picky here. I just felt that I don't think it's true to say that he has always had an unwavering belief in himself. I think it's truer that he's got the guts to keep going, to keep going, to knuckle down, to try and block out the noise, even though it is affecting him, has affected him, get on with it, and do just enough. Look, we were saying he was a liability a few weeks ago still, and he just, you know, he was part of a team that had a lucky win against Brentford. He was part of a team that just beat Sheffield United. And he got man of the match, as you were so eager to point out the other day. And now he scored a goal. Now, exactly, Martin. My next point is.
Was it on Sunday?
Let's see how we're discussing Harry Maguire after the next few weeks.
You know, I mean, that's the test. If you know, all the world over, as Graham Taylor said, this is a test. You know, Manchester City, you know, Sheffield United and Copenhagen. But they're matches that you would expect, you know, if you're looking at the success, the fantastic success of the England rugby team at the World Cup, what you would say is, okay, it was good. They were perhaps a little bit unlucky in the semi-final. But still, if you looked at that set of fixtures, they've lost the first game that you wouldn't have necessarily expected them to win. The rest of them, apart from the poor form before going into the tournament, but under normal circumstances, you would expect England to beat Argentina, you would expect England to beat Fiji, you'd expect England to beat Japan. The other teams go without saying. And then they've come to South Africa, which is the first game where you're looking at it thinking, God, this could go either way. And the way it went was for South Africa. It's like Manchester United. It's Copenhagen at home. It's Sheffield United. You know, what have they got so far? 1 point.
Mm.
So it's not like there's other teams really struggling to beat Sheffield United. Was it Newcastle? What
yeah, it was Newcastle.
Yeah, Newcastle.
Eight,
wasn't it? Yeah, was it eight? Yeah. I lost count. I lose count after six. And so Manchester City, now this is a test. And they don't have to win it because it's very hard to beat Manchester City. Not many teams do it. But, you know, let's see how close the match is and let's see how, you know, the Harry Maguire revival and, let's see it tested by Haaland and Alvarez and Phil Foden and whoever else decides to appear from nowhere when you least expect it, you know, as usually happens.
That will definitely be the test for Manchester United this weekend. Manchester City, of course, beating Young Boys 3-1 in another fairly comprehensive and comfortable win for Pep Guardiola in the Champions League. But from one United to another, Newcastle, a bit of a reality check, should we say, losing 1-0 at home to Dortmund. Now, listeners, I can't tell whether you can... pick up on this, but Gregor's slight chippiness is because he's not had enough coffee after a late night in Birmingham, which we'll come to in the second part of the show. But another man who had a late night
and the shot M1.
Oh, don't start M1 again. The other thrilling insight you missed, listeners, was before we hit record, these chaps just ranting about the roadworks in the UK motorway system.
Late.
But anyway, yeah. we'll save that for the outtake show at the end of the season. Martin, you had another late journey back from Newcastle as well because you were there at St James's Park.
Yes.
Am I right in my assessment of reality check, or was this a case of a Dortmund side showing them a bit more respect because of their performance?
Yeah, it was a reality check because I actually forgot it rains from the roof at the Newcastle day. That was a reality check, certainly for my suit. No, it's a reality check. It is and it isn't, in as much as I thought they were so impressive against PSG. And you can't forget that. You can't just have one match, one defeat that erases what they've done so far and the direction they're going. Borussia Dortmund are a good team. They're a very good team. I was quite surprised by Borussia Dortmund because you look at their results in the tournament so far and they haven't been setting the world alight. And then last night they were very, very well organised. They defended magnificently in the second half when they needed to. What I would say with Newcastle is that I'm not sure how, you know, there's a lot of English players in the team. It's not a team that's full of guys that have played 10 seasons in the Champions League. And what it looked like tonight, last night, they looked strangely a little leggy. And you couldn't quite work out why. And all I can think is that there's a lot of players there that aren't used to playing two matches a week of that intensity, because there's a world of difference between playing two games a week if the game in the middle of the week is the Carabao Cup and you're playing Newport County, or even if you're playing a Premier League team, half the players are rested, half of their players are rested. It's not the same. They've gone from playing Crystal Palace, who are difficult, they're a cussed team, and they played really well and put four past them. And then you're straight into Borussia Dortmund, who've got a lot of European experience and have got a great youth setup and a lively and organised and smart. And it looked as if that told. Plus, they lost a couple of players to injury, which made a big difference. And then you began to see little things that, you know, Callum Wilson came on for Isaac, and Callum Wilson's an outstanding club player, but the Champions League is this huge step up. It really is a huge step up. And he nearly scored, but it was never a game where you really thought Newcastle were going to come flying back. You know, Borussia Dortmund scored just before half-time. It wasn't a game where you thought, oh, this is going to end up 3-1 to Newcastle. From the minute that goal went in, you knew they had problems. You knew they had a job on their hands. And so there's a reason it took Manchester City, with all their money and all their wealth and all of the great players, there's a reason it took Manchester City a long time to win that tournament. And I'm not saying it's beyond Newcastle. and I'm not saying it's beyond them in a short space of time, but last night was the reality of two games in 4 days against teams that you've really got to be on it.
Johnny?
Yeah, I think you've got to play differently in Europe. And as Martin said, Man City went through a process. And I think one of the issues that Premier League teams have got, and this would go back to watching Ferguson and Wenger's teams actually struggle in the Champions League for initially, is that sort of toe-to-toe style of football doesn't necessarily work in Europe because teams will pick you off. So, remember Guardiola City, the game I always think about is that crazy quarter-final semi v Monaco.
Absolutely.
I mean, just it was just a free-for-all, wasn't it? And they went out by the odd goal in 9 or something like that. And it looked to me, and from watching the game on TV, that Newcastle sort of went toe-to-toe with Dortmund and came at them, but left plenty of space for Dortmund to come back at them. And the goal was exactly that. It was Anthony Gordon trying to go off on a solo mission and being dispossessed and being counter-attacked.
And as soon as that pass comes in from that goal, you just looked at it. As the guy squared the pass, I'm sitting there, goal.
Yeah.
Because you just knew. And it was a cracking finish or whatever, but they were so open at that particular point. As the guy made the square pass, you looked at it and thought, oh, they're absolutely wide open here. And sure enough, that was it. I totally... Look, I wrote after the PSG game, they're better set up to win the Champions League sooner than PSG. I stand by that 100% because I think they're building a team and a club in a very, very sensible way. And I think there's some very smart people at Newcastle United and that they will get it right. And they'll get it right quite quickly as well. However... There will be nights like that. Mm. There will be nights like that where they look like the new boys.
And a little bit stretched now.
Well, that was my next point. Not just injuries, but of course we have to mention Sandro Tonali, set to be banned from football for 10 months. Mm. Big superstar summer signing. Played incredibly well so far, but that's a huge, huge blow, isn't it, Gregor? And so some of those limitations that Martin and Johnny have outlined are going to be laid bare even more, aren't they?
Yeah, and Harvey Barnes is already out for... A few months with an injury, so that was their two big signings really of the summer. This is back to last season's team. Yeah. As you say, lost I think Isaac and Murphy last night.
Yeah,
Botman. So yeah, these have been important players for Newcastle, and you know, we're promising to be important players this season as well. The new signings. So this was always the problem. We you know, we looked at even a few weeks ago, we were saying actually they're pretty well stocked, but. Yeah. When you lose key players, it's still going to be a bit of a step back, step down in quality for them. And when they were fighting on several fronts, this was always the risk. I would also just add that I think if you looked at this group and you got to the midway point and you said you've got a win, a loss, and a draw,
they would
bite your hand off. So they're still well on another shout.
You know, they were talking last night. Everyone was saying, "Oh, we've got to go to Dortmund and beat Dortmund or whatever." Not necessarily. You haven't got to beat Dortmund. You know, if you can get a point out of Dortmund, if you could get a point at PSG, they're at home to AC Milan in the last game. AC Milan got a poor result against PSG last night. And when that group was drawn, the points we were making earlier about the Manchester United group, when that group was drawn, you looked at that and thought, it's tough. It was the sort of group that Man City used to get when they were first in the tournament. When you've got no coefficient and you're in pot four or whatever, this is what happens. This is what can happen to you.
Johnny, just on Tonali, do you think Martin's talked about a well-run club and a well-organised club? Will they react to that in the January transfer window?
I'm sure they'll try to, but they are sort of balancing things with FFP at the moment, and I think that will sort of continue to restrict them. But their recruitment has been excellent so far. They've got Dan Ashworth and a team of scouts that he's appointed who do a lot of work, I know, with data, and they've got a very good network. I'm sure they'll have plenty of options, and it'll just be the financial thing. I feel for Tonali though. I feel for Newcastle a bit as well. I was just looking forward to watching a season of that guy, and we'll have to wait.
Absolutely, we'll have to wait. We've mentioned Manchester City and their win in the Manchester United section. Just to finish off the Champions League review, Arsenal beating Seville 2-1. I've only really got one question on this, and it's around Gabriel Jesus. His stats in the Champions League are incredible when he starts. When he starts games in the Champions League, 17 games, 14 goals and 4 assists. He's a player that I love watching. He's a player that I have arguments with my Arsenal supporting friends.
He's a player that's got most of that playing for Manchester City.
Yeah, all right. So we know which side of the fence you're going to be on when I pose this question.
Any side of the fence whatsoever, I do think there's a little asterisk that said a lot of this was achieved with Manchester City, who are by far and away the best team in the strongest league in Europe.
That's a good point. But what I was going to say was that a lot of my Arsenal sporting friends are still to be convinced and still were very excited when they heard Tom Roddy on Monday's show talking about the potential of them signing Ivan Toney, still feeling they need a striker. I was just had a question just on Jesus and what type of a player he is and what we think of him. Is he 8 out of 10? Is he 8.5? Is he one of the best forward? Is he a forward? Is he a striker? Johnny, you're squeaming in your chair, so I'm going to ask you, obviously.
No, I'm because I thought you were going to ask what is he in terms of his position.
Like, what do you think of him as a player overall? Do you think he's that leading man for Arsenal?
I suspect he'd benefit from a number 9 coming in, and then he could do his work off the sides. I suspect he's one of them. I love him as a player, but there's a reason, I suppose, why he left Man City, which was, you know, Haaland coming in and him not being the out and out number 9 and Guardiola wanting something different off the sides. But I mean, just, yeah, look, he is, I was kind of half smiling because I just love watching the guy play. I think he brings a joy. His feet are brilliant. Still not entirely sure where I'd play him on the pitch, but I think a reference point and him being able to work around him would probably suit him better.
I think there's very few players in the Premier League who use the body as well as Gabriel Jesus. The amount of times you see him backing in to a defender and like wriggling and wrestling and squirming, you know, just like twisting them up and then scampering away. I always use the word menace with him. It's like he's playing street football a lot of the time when he's at his best. But is he the leading guy for Arsenal? That's always the one reason I've questioned that has been his fitness record, which again has cropped up in this game. And the other is, well, he scored goals and he, you know, his record is good. There's also some of the stats about his kind of underperformance of his XG and stuff have been pretty like alarming sometimes. He does miss some pretty big opportunities at times too. So I think there's consistency and there's fitness, and I think Arsenal would benefit from having another sort of focal point in their team, a different sort of player, someone who, not, you know, you're not going to sign a Haaland, but someone who occupies defenders, stays high up the pitch, because he is great at dropping deep and linking up.
Martin, you picked up on my lies, damn lies and statistics. But Jesus as a player, in light of what the guys have said,
I think he's a lovely footballer. I don't think he is a lovely footballer. I just don't think
he's some real damning with fame. Yeah, I
just don't think he is necessarily the prolific goal scorer. Sometimes you've got to match like with like. The reason that Cristiano Ronaldo was so impactful for Manchester United, and the reason he was a game-changing player for Manchester United, is they had nobody that could keep up with Frank Lampard. Frank Lampard was scoring 20 goals plus for midfield. And if he had continued scoring 20 goals plus for midfield, which he pretty much did, and Manchester United couldn't find that player, Chelsea win the league. Chelsea just keep winning the league because they can't get in front of them. And then what happens is they get a midfield player, as he was before he converted later in his career. But they get a midfield player who not only scores 20 goals from midfield, he scores 42 goals from midfield or whatever the number was. And that blows Frank Lampard out of the water, and suddenly Manchester United are the best team in the country again. So Manchester City have got Erling Haaland. Liverpool have got Mo Salah. They are scoring goals at a level. That's what Arsenal need to match.
Because otherwise, they don't have that in their team at all.
Exactly. Otherwise, it's going to be really hard when it matters to get in front of them, which is what happened in the end last season. When it really mattered, in the end, Manchester City chipped away at it. And one of the reasons they chipped away at it is they had this phenomenon playing, and Arsenal aren't going to get Erling Haaland or going to get an equivalent to Erling Haaland, but they've got to get nearer. It's Erling Haaland.
In fairness,
sheer numbers.
In fairness, they have had, you know, last season, they had Saka and Martinelli, I think probably reached double figures in goals and assists each.
Yeah,
Trossard came in and chipped in a big number. So they did manage to spread the goals around. Yeah.
They have a lot of players who do those things across the board, don't they? But I guess what Martin's saying is in game-changing moments, if you've got one player.
If you've got one player. I mean, the other... Look, Haaland isn't having, by his standards, certainly by last season, he isn't having his best season. But nonetheless, two goals last night and, you know... and. That group's as good as over, basically. They've got young boys at home in their next match, and you know, you'd have your house on that, and then it's 12 points from four games, and people don't get knocked out of the Champions League with that. And it's just that, as you say, it's those moments, it's those match defining moments. That's what makes the difference. Frank Lampard defined matches for Chelsea. And that's why they were so strong, so good.
Johnny, on Monday's show, Tom Ruddy discussed the idea of Ivan Toney going to Arsenal. Mm. Do you think that would be a good fit in light of what we've just discussed?
I think it'd be terrific. Yeah, he would not just be that reference point and just change the way they can play. Just give them a new dimension. He's just got such personality, Ivan Toney, and if you're also looking for someone culturally to shift the club up in terms of the fight that they face trying to overhaul Man City, you know, somebody that I think would have the self-belief, chutzpah, to think they could do it. I think Ivan Toney would fit that bill.
And a point to prove as well. Yeah. And a point to prove, because he seems like sort of quite an angry fellow. I don't know whose fault it's meant to be, but he seems like quite an angry man at the moment that he's out of football. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with a fellow who thinks he's got a point to prove to the entire world.
Absolutely. Fascinating discussion from this week's Champions League. You can read more of the best analysis from these guys and from the rest of the Times writers on the Times website now. Make sure you're subscribed by going to thetimes.co.uk/thegame for the latest digital offer. Stick with us, we're discussing Wayne Rooney next.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and I'm joined by Martin Samuel, Jonathan Northcroft, and Gregor Robertson. And Gregor, I alluded to it in part one, a little bit grumpy, a little bit tired, because you spent the night in Birmingham, and you've written a piece for The Times website, which is headlined, "Changing Too Much Too Soon Gives Wayne Rooney a Nightmare Start." Birmingham's new manager has asked the players to be brave on the ball, but after losing the first two games in charge, concedes they are not comfortable doing that. Rooney taking over at Birmingham. You were there last night. You were in the city before the game as well. What's the mood like in Birmingham beforehand? And then also, of course, tell us about that mood after full time.
Yeah, beforehand, you struggle to find people who are enthused about Wayne Rooney's appointment, to be brutally honest. And there are many reasons for that. You know, one is, and the biggest one is, that they feel that John Eustace, who he replaced, was sacked very harshly. Team were sixth after 12 games. Eustace is a kind of local boy. I think he played for the academy when he was younger before moving on and starting his career at Coventry. And he sort of bridged the takeover by the new American owners, which happened in the summer. So he dealt with a lot of the crap from the previous regime, and there was a lot of that, and dealt with it very admirably, kept them out of a relegation battle. And they started the season really well. They were, you know, disciplined, compact, as you know, had them up in and around the playoffs, although it's early days. So Rooney acknowledged that again last night afterwards. He said, you know, because the reaction at full time was pretty remarkable, actually. This was his home debut, you know, his home debut, home bow as manager. And it was a very muted sort of welcome onto the pitch before the game. They were booed off at half-time, and they were booed very loudly off at full-time. And there were some sort of pointed words from the crowd as well, which I alluded to in my piece. You know, it's been 2 weeks, two games, and, you know, how has it come to this already? So part of it, as I say, is to do with the man he replaced, and part of it is just the sort of the nagging feeling that the new owners, who have already got a lot of credit in the bank for their investment in the stadium, which was basically, you know, decaying before their eyes. There's still a huge swathe of unused, seatless concrete, because I think there was asbestos that they've had to repair, so it's been shut for ages. So they're investing a lot of money in the ground. They've got big plans. This ownership group obviously brought on board Tom Brady, the NFL legend. Brady visited in August and was kind of, you know, made an appearance in local pubs and stuff. And I think, you know, they could accept a sprinkling of celebrity stardust if it's kind of, it sort of underlines the ambition and the stature and what they hope to be. But it's kind of a sideshow. But when there's a feeling that they're doing the same thing with the man in the dugout, there's a bit more unease, because, you know, we could talk about Wayne Rooney's prior experience as a head coach, and I'm sure we will. I personally think he did a really, really admirable job at Derby County in the circumstances. His time in the MLS was he inherited a club, DC United, that were at the kind of lowest ebb. Didn't manage to make them into a sort of take them into an extended playoffs at the end of the season, and MLS observers have said that the same thing we're seeing now about is sort of this desire to overhaul the playing style. The same thing happened in DC United, and he very quickly realised the team weren't capable of doing it. And as I said in the piece, he's already making noises that he had a sort of dressing room inquest last night. He didn't come out till 10:30 to speak to us, which is another reason why I was home so late. Cheers, Wayne. and he said he asked the players to be honest. Are you not comfortable doing this? Because you don't look it. And they said, no, we're not comfortable. So he was brought in. The other thing to quickly point out is he's not been helped by the rhetoric that accompanied his appointment, which was about this no-fear style of football that he was brought in to implement, which kind of rather undermined the work done by Eustace, which also stoked the ire of the fans, and also gives, you know, heaps the pressure onto Rooney. And Rooney was happy to take that pressure, and he's backed it up. He said, this is the way I want to play. He wants to have, you know, the formation almost becomes a 2-3-5 when they've got the ball, but the two centre halves look completely out of their depth in possession, and then when they lose the ball and the fullbacks are high up the pitch, they're completely exposed out of possession. John Ruddy was 37 a couple of days ago. Same shares a birthday with Wayne Rooney, I noticed as well. He has suddenly been asked at this age to turn into David Raya, and David Raya struggling to be David Raya. So that's why the too much too soon thing. Rooney was admitted last night. He's got to ask himself that question: have I tried to do too much too soon? And I think the answer is yes.
Lots of points to pick up on there, Johnny. Rooney's someone that you know well, that you've worked with on columns for the Times and Sunday Times, of course. What do you make of some of the points Gregor made there, both about Rooney taking this job and the task that he's got, and some of the kind of noise around it that he's had to put up with?
Yeah, I'm fascinated listening to Gregor because I've been following it from afar because I haven't been to the games yet. But a lot of what Gregor's just said kind of had been nodding my head because it tallies with what I know of Wayne. I mean, to take it in order, I suppose, the reaction won't bother him. I mean, he's not known for bowing to pressure and has had a career where he's faced worse than a couple of fans booing him at the end of a game. But he'll also respect the fans' opinion because I think Wayne's roots are in Everton and probably a similar fan base to Birmingham in many ways. He'll know where the fans are coming from. So I don't think he'll be knocked too much by what's happened. I think he'll be quite realistic. He does have very, perhaps almost surprisingly, kind of Guardiola-esque ideas about how to play football. They're less influenced by Sir Alex Ferguson, more by, I mean, he said he said the best coach he had tactically at United was Louis van Gaal. So he's, and I don't think that's not a slight to Fergie, but the football he wants to play, he aspires to, is more of the Guardiola, van Gaal positional and expansive nature. His challenge, and he's been brought in to do that. It's not his fault that he was brought in to do that. But of course, he does face issues like John Eustace was rightly very popular and was unfairly treated. He deserved to keep his job. You know, Wayne didn't sack him; the club did. He also faces a championship which is getting better and better all the time, and I don't think there's as much margin for error as before. It would have been painful losing to Liam Rossini. They're good mates because it was his number two at Derby, and that would have stung a little bit. But he's kind of trying to do this mid-season probably with a squad that's not really equipped for it yet. I noticed he brought on Ramel Donovan, who's 16, and that might signal that he might try and shift towards youth.
Which he did quite a lot at Derby, of course.
Which he did
slightly enforced.
And he did it at DC. Well. I mean, he had a 15-year-old playing at one point. But the issue is going to be, as it is for all managers, it's time. And this is only two games into his reign, and they haven't gone very well. But he has tried to do the things that he's been brought in to do. He's so far trying to fulfil the brief. Now, what Gregor said about DC is completely correct. They did, after trying to open out, develop a more kind of pragmatic style of play, and then tried opening out again. And they only missed the playoffs by, it was more or less goal difference. So they weren't a million miles away. Derby was never able to do that. But I just say, come on, we live in a world where someone like Wayne Rooney and any manager, but you know, particularly a young English coach who's trying his very best to learn, who's trying to stretch himself by a move abroad, who's already shown he can lead in a club like Derby, surely he gets more than two games before he's being. I'm not saying Gregor's writing him off, but I'm just saying I can see the narrative already. And Wayne will accept the boos, but the kind of already the dancing in delight in some quarters, I think already at Wayne having two bad games is ridiculous, and give him a bit of time.
How much, Martin, do you think that narrative, and you mentioned two former England stars earlier in Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard, do we wonder whether maybe that kind of generation of players who've all had little chances in management at different levels...
More than little.
Some very big chances, but obviously, I'm referring a bit more to Rooney, but yeah, you're quite right, some very big chances. Do you think that some of that narrative that Johnny is talking about is football fans kind of having a ha-ha, you deserve it type thing? Because you got lucky by getting all these chances because you're famous England players.
Undoubtedly. And of course, that is also linked to the fact that John Eustace, who was not touched by stardust, was doing a really good job. There's a world of difference between Wayne Rooney going into a Birmingham team that is in the bottom four, you know, on its backside, desperate for any sort of win or fillip or just sort of impetus. And here is Wayne Rooney, Manchester United's top goal scorer, England's top goal scorer, and everyone would have been delighted. The mood yesterday would have been absolutely euphoric. Going into a Birmingham team that for the first time in living memory has actually won a few games and is in a position that they might do something, as you say, with a guy that is an ordinary Joe sort of manager, and then he gets swept aside, and we bring in a member of the golden generation that everyone, you know, talks of as the golden generation with a curled lip because, you know, we kept getting knocked out of the quarterfinals by Portugal. That is a recipe for exactly this sort of I was going to say disaster, but it's not a disaster. It's two matches, but it's a recipe for exactly this sort of opening where it doesn't go well. Everyone's suddenly furious. Everyone thinks you've only come in because, you know, you're famous and you know, they're all in awe of you. And this guy never stood a chance, and he was one of us, and he was our sort of guy, and he was doing well. It's a very predictable way that it could go.
I'm still sorry. Like, I kind of agree the recipe was there, but I think it was still really shocking to hear the level of anger almost on his home, his opening home game.
Furious now. We were all furious about a road that was closed 4 years ago, you know.
Before
this programme started, we were all like still carrying that, you know, that M11 closure from like 4 or 5 years ago and getting in at 4 o'clock in the morning. Everyone was furious. But everyone is furious. Gary Megson got booed into the job at Bolton. Can you remember? That was the start of it. That was the first time I ever noticed it. When Gary
Megson, I was trying to think
out
of anyone that this has happened to before, and I couldn't think of anyone. That's a good reference.
Got booed into the,
rare.
They didn't even wait for the match to be played. They just booed him as he walked out to take his place on the.
I played for Gary Megson, so I can empathise with that.
All I would say with Birmingham, and there's a name that cropped up in the all the appointments were being made, and it's a name, Gary Cook. Gary Cook came from Manchester City. Everyone's furious with Gary. You know, Gary Cook was, you know, he's that joker at Man City, tried to sign Kaká. If you speak to people at Manchester City about Gary Cook, no one who works there has a bad word to say about him. They think he was absolutely fabulous, that he made the modern club. And I'm not saying because he came in under Shinawatra and he said lovely things about Shinawatra, which is perhaps, he was certainly very dubious. But, you know, man likes his boss. He's not going to be the first person to say nice things about the bloke who's employing him. But anyway, when you talk to people about who built the modern Manchester City, Gary Cook is very, very high up there because he walked into a club and looked around on his first day and said to somebody, where's the HR department? And they said, there's Doris in accounts. So if you've got a problem with your salary, you go and see Doris and she sorts it out for you. He said, no, I'm talking about the HR department. No, I haven't got one of them. And he turned it into a modern business. It's before Mansur, you know, and then Sheikh Mansur comes in and then there's money and then he makes his comments about Kaká and so. But he wasn't wrong about where Man City could be going. He was absolutely spot on about where Man City could be going. So I think it would be wrong to presume that the people who've got Birmingham are mugs. And that the people they've got working for them are mugs. I think there will be an attempt to create a modern forward-facing football club. I'm not saying they've gone about it the right way because they had a good manager. And it might have been an idea to see what this guy could do first and say to Wayne Rooney, look, if this doesn't, you know, we've got to give John Eustace a chance. If it doesn't go well, Wayne, you're our man. I don't understand why they felt the need to make that change so quickly, because it was always going to heap a lot of pressure on this appointment and this situation and this run of matches, and it always risked a very, very difficult narrative for Wayne when he coming into this job. So that notwithstanding, I just think that they will be trying to change the culture at Birmingham City, which, let's be honest, has not been a culture that anyone would say, oh, that's how a football club should be run, for, what, 20 years? Yeah. 20-odd years?
Well, certainly in the last decade under Trillion Trophy Asia.
Oh, Trillion Trophy. I mean the world's most ironically named conglomerate.
A really kind of, mysterious mob. Who also, like, there are also echoes, we should say, which also might add to the feeling of unease of when they arrived a few months later. They sacked Gary Rowett in December 2016 and replaced him with the very, the much more recognisable Gianfranco Zola, and they spiralled towards the foot of the table, and that was really the start of a decade of sort of a lost decade, really. Then came Harry Redknapp, with spent an absolute fortune, and then very badly shackled them with a lot of debt, and then the FFB troubles came. So it's been a tough year for tough decade for Birmingham, and no one is saying that the new owners are mugs. In fact, they've done a lot of good things already, and they've their own record is saying they want to turn Birmingham into a footballing powerhouse. They want to take them right to the top, so it just feels like they've tried to kind of run before they could walk, on the footballing side here.
Just a problem that they didn't have. The manager wasn't the problem. You could make a long list of problems at Birmingham City, but the guy that's got them to sixth in the league on a next to nothing budget, he wasn't the problem.
And even if you were gonna sack him and bring in Rooney, just like maybe tone it down a little bit about making it such a step change, because it did sort of pour cold water on everything that had gone before. And it was also saying we'll implement a culture and identity that everyone connected to, every Birmingham team will embrace and identify with. It's like they're almost telling the fans what they're going to think and feel and believe and what they want, when what they really wanted was a bit of stability.
Mm. Johnny, final word from you on Rooney. In light of some of those points that the guys have made, he does seem to take on quite challenging jobs, doesn't he, in lots of respects. And, we've got to admire him for that. But you've also got to think, this is a young guy trying to make his way in the game. And I've referred to, the kind of narratives of, oh, you're just lucky, you just get the jobs. Is he not helping himself by maybe picking some of these more challenging scenarios, if you like?
Well, I mean, I think the reality is that, and maybe because of what's happened to Lampard and Gerrard, that those opportunities aren't as glitzy as they once were. I think the Premier League's now in a phase where it'd be almost incredible if a Premier League club out of the blue just appointed a big former player who didn't have any managerial experience. But that used to happen in our very recent memories. So, and Wayne's very aware he has to take on challenging jobs and graft, and he said to me before that what I did as a player doesn't count for anything, because I was a big player doesn't mean a thing. He'll just work really hard, and he will have the personal resources to deal with the pressure. It sounds kind of bland to say it again, but it will just come down to how much time he's going to be given. I just hope he does get the time, and then we can all judge him, because I think what you're alluding to, Tom, is that he hasn't had a clear run at jobs so far where you could make a judgment about how good
who he is, what a coach he is, all that kind
Derby
of stuff.
Derby was one whole firefight after another.
It was about personality more than kind of a capacity as a coach.
It was a personality job. And DC was, a basket case club at the start of the reign, and he took them so far but didn't finish the job. So That's just something you
well to withhold using the phrase basket case until you got to Washington DC and not just going early with it on Derby County. You know?
Yeah, we're seeing this, you know, he's picking jobs.
Special category of basket case.
This is a good job. This is a good opportunity.
Well, it is.
No, it's a very good job. It's a much better job. But I'm just saying that you and Martin have done a very good job of outlining why it's not an ideal scenario for a young manager.
But he's not
been
helped.
The surrounding circumstances have not been helped. So that was the only point I was trying to make.
The circumstances are what makes it difficult, not the position itself. No. Because going to a championship club with owners that are backing you and prepared to put money in, that's a dream scenario, because that wasn't Derby.
No.
You know, Derby, as John described it, one firefight after another. Mm. And there's a lot of clubs in that division where you're going in there and your bottom line is, can I keep this lot up? Can I stop us going skint? You know, you look at all the teams that occupy, say, the bottom six places at the moment, there's far more risk involved of, you know, not being able to save the team, not being able to keep them in the division, than Wayne would expect to have at Birmingham City.
Yeah, absolutely. It will definitely be a storyline and a narrative, Johnny, that we will return to many times this season. I wanted to finish the show with the sad news at the passing of Bill Kenwright, the Everton chairman, who died on Tuesday, age 78. He had been on the board at Everton since 1989 and taking over as chairman in 2004. Obviously, we've just talked about running of clubs, management of clubs, and alluding to some ownership models and things. Martin, you wrote a tribute piece on the Times website to Bill Kenwright and talked about a slightly unique figure in modern football he became, in the way that he was just a fan who just wanted to be part of his club and ended up at the very top of it.
Yeah, that's what Billy was. He was a fan. And that, perhaps, sometimes maybe it's not the best thing to be a fan. Maybe you need some hard-nosed, you know, person to run a football club. Bill was so emotionally engaged with Everton all the time. I mean, he was a theatrical guy as well, very easily moved to tears by, you know, anything really, just almost anything really. But I felt for Bill. I really did feel for Bill, because he would have done anything for it to be a different scenario at Everton. He would have done anything to find a buyer that was more solid than some of the people that have been circling around Everton, not just lately, but previously. He went a long way down the road with a group from Asia that were going to buy them and stuff. And then it's getting quite close to it, and they say, well, you need to put the money in, just to, you know, the good faith, to do the due diligence or whatever. And it wasn't turning up, and they start looking at it, and the guy that is meant to be behind it lives in a flat in Manchester, and they can't find any, you know. And he was plagued by this sort of stuff all the time, and he really did want the best for the club. He always wanted the best for the club, and just a very nice guy. You know, which should be said as well. Just a very nice guy. Everyone likes him in football, and everyone could see how hard he was trying for Everton. And being asked to stay away from the club for security reasons was heartbreaking for him. I know, that was just terrible for him. He'd already got to the stage where he couldn't travel to the club on public transport. He had to go in his own car. That hurt him a lot as well, because he did genuinely like talking to the fans. And, you know, even when there was the beginnings of dissent, you know, the only time he ever phoned me up and said, oh, you've got that wrong, was when I described a fan coming towards him at the end of the game and him shooting away rather than speaking to him. And he said, no, you got that wrong. We talked on the stairs it was out of my sight or whatever. Because he did genuinely want to talk to the fans about, you know, the future of the club and where it was and where it was going and stuff like that. So, a lovely guy and a true fan. And I hope he's remembered as that. I hope when it comes to Everton's next game and they do something for Billy, I hope that the majority of the fans appreciate him as an Evertonian.
Johnny, climb away from you.
No, lovely work. I'd echo exactly that portrayal of Bill. He became a kind of lightning conductor for understandable anger of supporters, understandable in the sense it's a fan base that's been let down so badly over the last 10 years by ownerships, and Bill got blamed for that, but Bill never had the money. You know, he and I think the Bill that should be remembered is the guy that, without whom, I don't know what would have happened to Everton between 2001 and whatnot, because he was he put his energies into saving that club and rebuilding that club, gave, as Martin said, you know, everything time wise emotionally to it. I took a very personal touch to running it. You know, David Moyes and him had a very close relationship, and the appointment took place, I think, when at Bill's house. You know, he ran it on that personal basis. David drove to the house in London and did the deal there, and they formed a really good partnership. Not they didn't always agree, because there was never quite enough money, but they did form a really good working relationship. I remember Bill's tears when Wayne Rooney was being sold.
His famous, Alex is telling of that story.
The famous story about Bill's on the phone to his mum, you know, mama, mummy, they're trying to sell our boy, you know.
Stealing our boys. Yeah, stealing our boy whilst crying. Fergie's sitting opposite him thinking, this is not for real.
But that was him, wasn't it? As you said, he was from the world of theatre. And I think supporters complained in the end that he wouldn't let go, but I think he didn't let go, because he, having been the man that saved Everton, he still felt a need to be there, because other people couldn't be trusted, and I think perhaps he was right in that.
A remarkable man, remarkable career in football and elsewhere in entertainment as well, Martin, as you referenced. You can read Martin's tribute to Bill Kenwright on the Times website now, and also a fascinating obituary as well from our obits department. Martin Samuel, Johnny Northcroft, Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for joining me, and thank you for listening. Make sure you're subscribed, because we'll be back on Monday with all the best reaction from the weekend's action. Thanks for listening.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.